Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And you know, the thing about political stalemates is that they seem like nothing is going to change, and then they can end very, very quickly. And that was certainly the case in Ukraine over the past few days, as a political stalemate escalated into some of the worst violence seen in Ukraine since World War II. And then, just as it seemed as though the fiery pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych, had averted his own ouster with a compromise call for new and early elections, Yanukovych was out. He is now wanted for the deaths of protesters and civilians as the government cracked down on street demonstrations in Kiev over the past week, causing dozens of fatalities. Someone who has watched it all unfold is reporter Andriy Kulikov, who has been broadcasting to the world over his improvised, largely digital network as Ukraine Public Radio. Andriy Kulikov, welcome back.
Thank you.
So when we spoke on Friday, we were just on the verge of some monumental changes. Who's running the show right now in Kiev, Andriy?
It seems that no one is quite sure who's running the show. On the surface of it, it's the opposition, the official opposition. Mr. Turchinov, one of the leaders of the major opposition party, Batkivshina, has been elected chairman of the parliament, and then he assumed the responsibilities or duties of the president, the acting president. But there are some very active groups called mostly right sector on the side of the opposition who are widely believed to be the driving force of the revolution, as many people call it here. And of course, their opponents say it's a coup d'etat. On the other hand, the activity of many, many so-called ordinary people has flared up on both sides, and those who opposed the old regime are taking arms in their hands or at least forming some detachments that try to keep order in many, many cities throughout the Ukraine. On the other hand, in eastern and southern regions, their opponents are forming the same kind of neighborhood watch, or call it whatever you want. And I've been to the second largest Ukrainian city, Kharkiv, these past 2 days, and I witnessed clashes between those who oppose the old regime and those who are still in favor of Mr. Yanukovych, or at least against his opponents.
Describe in a little more detail for us who actually would accept the rule of this parliament by decree that's now taking place, and who absolutely considers them illegitimate and would not follow their authority whatsoever.
Quite a lot of people who think that the previous regime was corrupt to the root would welcome, and they are welcoming, any change. Although some of them are smirking and saying that we sort of exchanged tit for tat, and the new guys are actually same old guys, only from the other side of the political divide. Many people are still very satisfied that Mr. Yanukovych and his closest allies have gone for good, or at least they think that they have gone for good. They say anything or anybody is better than Yanukovych and his allies.
Well, what's the betting, Andriy? What is the betting on Yanukovych? What are his whereabouts? The likelihood he'll be brought into custody? Could he pop up anywhere else in the world and try to make a comeback here?
The latest that was seen on the internet was a photo of his yacht that was supposedly being stocked with some stuff in Balaklava in the Crimea, but this is not confirmed. Also, there's an official report about how he gathered his personal guards and told them that those who want to leave me now, and I'll go into hiding or into secret travel with the rest of you. This happened in Donetsk region, one of the eastern parts of Ukraine, where which is very close to Russia and where there are predominantly Russian-speaking population, and also which is actually a bulwark of Mr. Yanukovych's supporters. Because he's been, he comes from those places. He's been a governor of this region for several years, and most of the ministers and other administrative officials were recruited by him from this region. At the moment, there's no clue about where he might be, but one of the activists published a appeal on the internet for Ukrainians to donate at least 1 hryvnia, which corresponds to something like 10 cents or 12 cents, and in this way to collect the sum of money which will be given to anyone who can catch Mr. Yanukovych. So that's on the one hand how people feel towards, and I've been told that in 2 hours they've collected something like 800,000 hryvnia, which is approximately $100,000.
Which is a tiny amount of money for someone like Yanukovych in a place where, as you say, there are probably plenty of locations where he doesn't need to wander around with a disguise. He'll be welcomed with open arms and be safe, at least for the time being. Andriy Kulikov, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Andriy Kulikov is a Public Radio Ukraine correspondent in Kiev. He's been all over the country during these momentous moments. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Joining us now is Oleh Rybachuk, former member of the parliament before the Orange Revolution in 2006, former deputy prime minister in the former Tymoshenko government, former chief of staff. He's a civic activist now, founder of an NGO and a think tank in Ukraine. Oleh Rybachuk, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What do you think the future of Yanukovych is at this point, and how should the U.S. and Russia approach what's happened in the past few days?
Well, Yanukovych is the first Ukrainian president who managed to get millions of Ukrainians twice when he was prime minister in 2003, and he caused Orange Revolution and nowadays. But nowadays, he is in big, big trouble. He is a criminal, and he is the first Ukrainian president who gave shooting orders to police, because right now there are documents confirming this. So now he's in hiding somewhere in Crimea. Yanukovych perfectly qualifies to the international criminal law for the crimes against humanity. And right now, last night, he was trying to hide in Crimea, in Sebastopol, the place where Russian Black Sea Fleet is situated. So Russia is very close to, well, to interference into Ukrainian affairs. Moreover, Russians has called back their ambassador yesterday, because Russian Prime Minister Medvedev is saying that life is not safe for Russian citizens. I do hope very much that United States, which a few times acted very timely and prominently advising our army not to go against its own people and give a signal to President Yanukovych that there is no place in this world for somebody who is guilty of killing hundreds of innocent protesters.
But the confusion that you express there is precisely the confusion of someone like Secretary of State John Kerry. Who do you embrace at this point, given the divisions within Ukraine? There are some Russian-speaking places in Ukraine that probably won't be recognizing this government immediately.
Now, there is no threat like that. It's important to know that there is Donetsk is the city where Yanukovych is coming from. And this city is more than 1 million population. And you know how many protesters went into the street against ousted president? 100 people. 100 people versus millions of protesters all over the country. Yanukovych was rather artificially playing on the feelings of people. But today, when the whole nation is seeing his outrageously rich and tasteless palaces in Crimea, everywhere over Ukraine. When people see who was their leader, those people from the East see who was their leader, they are outraged. So we are not seeing any signs of country splitting. We see some parts of corrupted officials associated to Yanukovych who try to play this game, but to no success. So I can't see that the country is split, and there is some local authorities refusing to recognize center decision. It's not the case.
All right, but so we're speaking with Oleh Rybachok. Let's speak for a moment about Yulia Tymoshenko, who spoke before the protesters. Does she have a play here?
Sir, her appearance was led to very confused and mixed feelings, including myself. I've been working with her for a decade, probably. In short, I know her well, well. She left into prison 2 years ago, and she came back in very different country. But she has not changed. She has not learned. She tried to use the same political tricks. And on Maidan, she was so inappropriate that it was obvious. So I guess Ukrainians are very happy she's out of prison. But I don't think Ukrainians think their future should be tied up to politicians' type of Tymoshenko.
There's an analysis here that this is all about throwing out the old, all of the evidence of corruption on both sides in Ukraine, yeah, and bringing in a completely new breed of politicians. Can the government withstand that, a completely new, change of the guard without any continuity whatsoever?
Well, no, there will be a intermediate government, which we actually have. What we have now, we have a date of next presidential elections. This is May 25. And I am pretty sure that after that, the nation would demand new elections of parliamentarians, because now parliament consists of old party, which overnight became very progressive, very pro-European, and they are blaming only their leader, Yanukovych. People are not buying that. The whole system should be reset, and people are very, very determined to demand that. Therefore, we are having right now this transitional period, which will take a few months, but roughly in half a year, we will have the political scenery completely different, because this is what absolute majority of people is demanding. And if not for the people, politicians would again make a deal behind closed doors, as they used to do during last 22 years of independence. But now this time is gone.
All right. Oleh Rybachok, former member of parliament before the Orange Revolution, former deputy prime minister in the former Tymoshenko government, predicting a complete political reset in Ukraine. Mr. Rybachok, thanks so much.
Thank you.
More news this hour, a political surprise in Egypt, a Mexican drug kingpin in custody after years of being on the run, another look at the new Ukraine, a Supreme Court challenge to climate change regulation, and playing hockey without legs.
There's no woe is me attitude with these players. That's one of the concerns that I had taking over, was how do we handle these people psychologically? And what I've found is it's no different than any coaching situation I've ever been in. You have to read your players. You have to find out what makes them tick.
A PBS documentary on the Paralympic sled hockey team from the USA, a last chance to win gold from the hot Canadians later this hour. We always want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. You're listening to The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And now from Mexico, the $3 billion man, drug lord El Chapo, the kingpin of the Sinaloa drug cartel, is in custody of Mexican authorities who considered him Mexico's most wanted man. Even Chicago law enforcement called Joaquin Guzman Loera enemy number one. Over the weekend, he was captured in a joint effort by Mexican authorities and the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration after a manhunt that lasted over a decade, stretched across at least five continents. Joan Grillo joins us. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome, Joan.
Good to be here.
So this is a very significant capture. I'm wondering what it was that basically triggered him finally coming into apprehension. It seemed at the end he was pretty weary of being on the run.
Well, he'd been on the run for 13 years since he escaped from a so-called maximum security prison in Mexico by going out with the laundry. And he'd been moving around, and they think he was moving around this mountainous area, the Sierra Madre Occidental, big mountainous area in Mexico, big enough to hide an army in, as Pancho Villa hid an army there when he ran away from General Pershing after he attacked New Mexico back in the Mexican Revolution. So he was moving around different safe houses there. And a guy, although he was a billionaire on the Forbes billionaire list, although I don't think it was an exact science, but though he had billions of dollars selling cocaine, crystal meth, heroin and marijuana to Americans, perhaps he couldn't really enjoy all that money being on the run. So he started getting a bit sloppy and going back to the cities of Culiacán and Mazatlán and going into luxury houses, apartments there with various wives and girlfriends and trying to enjoy some of that money. And that was maybe what led to his capture.
So, you know, the old Shawshank Redemption scenario there, going out with the laundry in prison. I mean, very, very humble, you know, survival techniques on the part of El Chapo to stay alive. But what did him in the end is that he basically wanted to live a little over the last 13 years.
Yeah, he did. They started raiding some houses, arresting certain people, tracking cell phones, listening in on wiretaps, even having some drones in there following some things. An effort, as you said, between the U.S. administration, the DEA, and maybe some other agencies, maybe some spy agencies involved.
How much of this do you think is the technology being developed to track someone like this? And how much of this is a realignment in the economy of the drug business in the sense that there's a proliferation of crystal meth production in the United States, legalization of marijuana in two states in the United States? It suddenly makes a drug kingpin maybe worth a little bit less.
Well, the technology thing is very interesting. I think these manhunts, it has been compared to the manhunt for Osama bin Laden. So an unfortunate comparison because they're obviously very different figures. Guzman's more like a Pablo Escobar and Al Capone than bin Laden. But it's interesting how you get such a high-profile figure and they can escape justice for a long time. So the technology, the people are trying to, you know, I think it's hard to stay off the radar eventually. As they've shown with Chapo Guzman, with bin Laden, with other figures, they're going to catch up with you eventually if you're a figure who's this connected. In terms of the drug policy reform, it's a very interesting time when you still have the Mexican army burning marijuana crops in a mission supported by the United States, yet there's marijuana legalized in Colorado, Washington State, medical marijuana in a whole bunch more states. So it's kind of the drug wars at a very funny place right now, or the war on drugs. You know, we've got policy changing, but still this real fighting and violence on the ground and these military-backed efforts to take down kingpins like Chapo Guzman.
So what of the drug cartel Sinaloa? Do they go legal in this environment? What do they do? Do they shift away from, you know, crystal meth and cocaine and move towards drugs that might be legal agricultural commodities in 10 years?
Well, that's going to be very interesting how this will play out on the ground. There was a guy who was giving a talk in Mexico about the book with a bunch of people, and the guy said he knew a lot of cartel members, and he said, what are they going to do if marijuana is legalized? You know, you've got to keep these guys in work. So it's kind of obviously some concern there in the ranks about what it would mean. When you have a legal business, it totally changed the dynamics. The reason that drugs are worth so much money is because they're illegal. Cocaine, when it's coca leaves in Colombia, it's worth about $80 for what makes a kilo. It's worth about $2,000 when it becomes a kilo brick, and it's worth some $150,000 when it's sold here in New York on the streets. So that markup is absolutely enormous. It's an incredible business, and that's why everyone goes crazy killing each other to try and own that business. And if it was legalized, it would take that money out of the black economy, and it would become like alcohol or like anything else where you have to, you know, make up you know, make it for 20 pesos, sell it for 22 pesos, and that kind of, you know, hard markup.
Well, finally, then, look over the past 20 years. I mean, 20 years ago, if we were speaking, could we have imagined that the situation in Colombia today, which is so radically different from what it was 20 years ago, would have transpired the way that it has, and that the drug war in Mexico right now seems to be winding down on some level, and that the political stability is being reasserted even as legalization is taking place north of the border?
Well, the drug war in Mexico, it's something the government's done very well in selling itself as holding things down better, selling things as, you know, as being quieter. The escalation of the Mexican drug war, which went on from 2008 to 2011, has kind of plateaued. Before, we were seeing years where it was tripling, quadrupling the level of homicides. Now we're seeing about a kind of plateaued level of some 20,000 homicides a year, still very, very many killings in Mexico. But there's still parts of the country which are pretty crazy. I've just been in Michoacán state, where people have been so fed up of the drug cartel moving into extortion and kidnapping, they've taken up arms themselves, have become vigilante militias. They got barricades, AK-47s, and are reclaiming towns, and some quite crazy scenes. So still a lot of things going on there before this drug war in Mexico is over.
Not exactly the moment to buy real estate in Juárez, perhaps.
Well, Juárez maybe is a city which might have bounced back, but there's certain places in Mexico, yeah, where it is a difficult situation, and yeah, definitely still a lot of concern about safety, public safety right there.
Well, this is certainly a milestone. El Chapo in custody, the kingpin of the Sinaloa drug cartel, most wanted man in Mexico. Juan Grillo, journalist who has covered Mexican cartels for more than a decade, author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Juan, thanks as always.
Good to be here.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Now on political surprises in the Middle East. Is it a procedural shuffle to benefit an Egyptian military mission to assume power, or a new stage in the political turmoil in Cairo? The Egyptian cabinet resigned en masse today, making Egypt look that much more like the military dictatorship of the days of Nasser, Sadat, and Mubarak. Joining us now is Louisa Lovelock, correspondent for the Global Post in Cairo. Louisa, welcome.
Hello there.
So is this just a procedural matter, and it really paves the way for General al-Sisi to run for president and basically restore the status quo before 2010?
Well, it's very difficult to say at the moment. There are two interpretations that we're currently working on. One is, as you say, that Sisi has to resign his position as defense minister before he can run for president. And so this is perhaps what today's mass resignation was. But on the other hand, it's surprising that the whole cabinet would resign with him. And the cabinet has been growing increasingly unpopular and has been under increasing pressure in recent weeks with a new wave of strikes, with cooking gas shortages. So a lot of people here are now saying perhaps this is more to do with the unpopularity of the cabinet than it is to do with Sisi's immediate presidential ambitions.
Although the cabinet was appointed by the military people in power right now, so I suspect their lack of popularity bleeds over into al-Sisi. No, yes?
No, that is certainly the case. And there is an argument to say that Sisi is jettisoning the cabinet prior to his run for presidency, because the cabinet is very heavily associated with the economic failures of the country. And Sisi has, the past few months, been a figure who has risen to prominence from near obscurity, and who has really been very, very removed from the day-to-day problems of the country and is treated with a near sort of cult of personality by many Egyptians.
So it really is a restoration of the Sadat style of governance, where you match the cult of personality against any sort of constitutional democracy and all of the instability that comes with that. That's what's going on right now.
It certainly seems that way, and it does look like a return to Mubarak era politics, where the personalities in the cabinet don't matter and it's the president that you really focus on.
And what procedurally happens next? If al-Sisi explicitly decides to run for president, would there be a challenge? Is there any capacity for challenging him, a constituency out there?
Well, there will be presidential challengers. There's a leftist candidate called Hamdine Sabahi who will challenge him in the formal sense and that he will run. But to be honest, there are no clear challengers who will in any way threaten his presidential ambitions if he wants it.
And with are the Islamists? There's no way back for them. Their discrediting is complete. And for now, as the military returns to its kind of cult of personality status, the Muslim Brothers are content to stay underground?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood have largely been pushed underground. There's no ambition on the part of the military-backed authorities to reconcile with them, and they've all been pushed from political life. The problem now is that there are a series of extremist jihadist groups who are mounting attacks across the country. There's no evidence to suggest so far that they are linked to the Muslim Brotherhood, but as the Muslim Brotherhood's members are pushed from political life, some of them are certainly suggesting that they too may turn to violence.
But there's no pathway for Egyptian Islamists to vote with their feet in the upcoming elections.
Doesn't look like it. They certainly don't look like they'll have a candidate.
Louisa Lovelock is a reporter for the Global Post in Cairo, reporting on the mass resignation of the Egyptian cabinet, which could pave the way for the running for president of General al-Sisi. Louisa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Takeaway, I'm John Hockenberry. So could the issue of climate change eventually pit the executive branch of the U.S. government against the legislative branch?
I will direct my cabinet to come up with executive actions we can take now and in the future to reduce pollution, prepare our communities for the consequences of climate change, and speed the transition to more sustainable sources of energy.
Doing that by going around Congress, President Obama speaking last year about initiatives he had planned and has already begun. Today, one of these initiatives is being challenged before the U.S. Supreme Court in Utility Air Regulatory Group versus the Environmental Protection Agency. Joining us is Jody Freeman, director of the Environmental Law Program at Harvard Law School and former White House counselor for energy and climate change. Jody Freeman, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So is climate change going to become a separation of powers argument before the Supreme Court again and again? And this is merely the first real argument?
Well, that's how industry certainly sees it. They're trying to portray this as, you know, presidential overreach and the agency is out of control. But the truth of the matter is the agency is really trying to just implement the Clean Air Act to address greenhouse gases in a quite careful and targeted way. So we'll see how it plays out today. It's actually a more politically important case than legally important at this point.
But isn't there an argument, and I'm not saying I buy this argument, but within the Clean Air Act, the way that it stipulates that the federal government shall regulate something that's been scientifically determined, blah, 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 the scientific determination is the trigger. And they're going to argue today that it's not the Congress ruling, it's not even the president ruling, it's a priesthood of scientists that can determine federal policy independent of Congress. Isn't that how it flies?
Not quite, almost. Industry is saying that just because EPA has set a standard for greenhouse gases coming from cars and trucks, it doesn't mean that that triggers all the other programs under the law. So the government says, we've already set this standard for cars and trucks. There's an automatic lever that's pulled in the law, and that means we have to regulate stationary sources like plants and factories that produce GHGs too. And industry says, wait a minute, this second program is really aimed at local conventional pollutants that threaten public health. It's not designed for greenhouse gases.
How is the court likely to view this? Are the Scalias of the world going to look at every individual program needing to be approved by Congress in the way that, you know, automotive standards either were approved or at least aren't being challenged? Or are they going to view one size fits all here?
That's the question. You've got at least four justices on the court, remember, who dissented in the first big climate case, Massachusetts versus EPA. They're still there, and it's hard to predict whether they're going to decide that they'd like to send a message to the Obama administration that they should be careful and that the first case, Mass versus EPA, was not a blank check. They might want to send that message and say, look, we're going to scrutinize this program by program. Be careful you don't overstep. But the EPA is on pretty good legal ground here, and they're actually trying in this program to be deregulatory. It's a funny posture. The agency has said, we only want to regulate the very biggest sources of greenhouse gases. We want to limit our regulations to the biggest polluters. And it's industry that's objecting. So it's a little bit backwards in this case. Like I say, though, in the end, it's more politically important than legally. No matter what happens, even if the government loses, nothing in this case is going to get in the way of them carrying out the president's climate action plan. In fact, their greenhouse gas agenda for power plants, which is the big program, isn't going to be hampered by this at all. What really matters is, even if they lose in a small way, it's going to be portrayed as a major political setback and a check on the president. So it's really going to play out more as a media phenomenon, not really a legal phenomenon.
Why wasn't the EPA challenged when it was enacted back in the 70s?
Well, the Clean Air Act has been probably one of the most litigated laws ever. But I think the biggest controversy now is, does this law really apply to greenhouse gases? And the Supreme Court settled that. They settled it back in 2007. And I think industry wants to keep coming to the court to say, look, every time EPA issues a regulation, we're going to challenge it and try to set them back. But I think EPA is on pretty solid legal ground saying, we're just following the statute and we're actually trying to make it as minimally burdensome as we can on industry by going after the big guys.
All right, Jody Freeman, director of the Environmental Law Program at Harvard Law School, former White House counselor for energy and climate change. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Even though the Canadians reasserted their dominance in Olympic hockey by winning gold for the men and women in the Sochi Olympics, there's one more shot for the U.S. team.
Right wing circle makes a nice move, still has the puck to the side of the net, turning with it. Has a man heading to the net, Bowden a shot with a left-handed ambidextrous move and a very fine save there by Cash to keep it a scoreless game.
We're kind of a hodgepodge of the disabled world. We have four military veterans on our team who have lost some legs in Afghanistan and Iraq. We have players with spina bifida. We have players that unfortunately had just personal accidents.
It's the disabled to the rescue. That's Dan Brennan of the U.S. Paralympic U.S. sled hockey team talking about his team's athletic gifts and physical deficits as part of the PBS documentary Ice Warriors, U.S. Sled Hockey, a profile of the U.S. national team as they prepare for the Paralympic Winter Games in Sochi. Taylor Chase is co-captain, and Judith Vecchione is the executive producer of the film, a project she was drawn to, she says, because she just fell in love with the action-packed sled game.
I come from Boston, and in Boston we are sports mad, so of course I love hockey. And learning about sled hockey, which I picked up, oh, I don't know, 4 or 6 years ago, I started being interested in it and went to some games. It's an amazing experience. It's fast, it's rough, it's exciting, and the level of skill is just amazing.
Give me a visual sense of how sled hockey works, because you've got to use your hands to propel and your hands to actually move the puck around. Just describe the challenge of having to do everything with your arms, Taylor.
Yeah, it's definitely a unique position to be in, and one physically that your body isn't naturally supposed to attempt to do. But the sleds are very lightweight, and for a player like myself who carries around quite a bit of weight, I have two legs still connected to my body. So for me, it's a little more challenging even because I've got so much weight to push around. But it's something that you can train for, and fortunately, your body's an amazing piece of equipment, I guess.
Judith, in looking at this game, is this like the hockey you grew up with? Is it a pickup game? Is it something that's very elite? Is it the kind of thing that really has the qualities of, you know, neighborhood hockey, which grew up to be an Olympic sport, and, of course, the NHL?
You know, it feels to me very much like hockey. The players are strapped into sleds. They're sitting on these two narrow blades. They've got these sticks that have both the shooting ends and the picks that the players use to propel themselves down the ice. But it's the same game. You're protecting the goalie. You're defending against their offensive moves. You're thinking about the passing from player to player is just amazing. In fact, that's one of the things that's really different is the sled hockey players shoot with both hands. They have two sticks, not one. So it feels the same in its emotion and its skill level, but it feels very different in these specific little areas.
What is it like to be that close to the ice? I mean, there's speed, but there's also proximity to the ice, which changes the whole nature of the game.
It's amazing. You think about how dangerous it is to play stand-up hockey. When you're on the ice in a seating position, you're really right at the level of the sticks, the sleds, the puck coming at you, the boards also. When you ram into the boards, you're right there. So there's a lot of action going on that takes managing. And some of the people playing this game, one of Taylor's teammates, for example, has brittle bone disease. He's just figured out how to play this game that he doesn't break every single bone in his body. The skill level, as I say, is phenomenal.
So, Taylor, how did you come to this sport? What brought you here?
Hockey, actually, believe it or not. And I never envisioned myself in this situation, of course. Being an able-bodied athlete from 4 years old, learning how to skate up until I was 16 when I was injured in a junior hockey game in Canada, I was heading down the ice into the offensive zone, carrying the puck at full speed. The next thing I remember, I was hit from the side, and the hit spun me going back first into the boards full speed, landed on the ice. I thought I had just kind of the wind knocked out of me at first, and then I suddenly realized that I couldn't feel or move my legs at all or anything from the waist down. So, you know, I was 16 years old at the time, so I was just scared. And through rehabilitation, I actually found the sport of sled hockey. And, you know, I have so many things to be thankful for, you know, in my life. And one of them is being a part of Team USA now. And it all happened through really a tragic accident, like all of my teammates. But somehow we came out of it wearing a USA jersey. So,
Taylor, I suspect you've had some interaction with NHL players. How much have they commented on the toughness of what it is you're doing? And who is it you most admire in the NHL right now?
This year's been really special in terms of support from the NHL, just because one particular player, David Backes for the St. Louis Blues, he was on the 2010 men's Olympic team. So all after the Paralympics and the Olympics are over, Team USA, both Paralympics and Olympics, it represents USA and goes to the White House. And you get to meet the president, and all the athletes get to be together as one team. So anyways, we're at the White House. David Backes comes up to us and, hey, guys, you know, I've seen sled hockey and this and that. And, you know, of course, we're just in awe of David because, you know, he's an NHL all-star and he's coming to talk to the sled hockey players like, you know, who cares about us? And but he was in awe of us, and that's what we, you know, really realized. And he just respected the heck out of us and really just embraced our team. But the sad part was that he was the only player from the U.S. men's able-bodied team that was there, represented from their team, which is really unfortunate because you got to remember that we're all on the same team. And Paralympics, Olympics, all that kind of stuff, it doesn't matter. In the end, we all represent USA, and we're all hockey players in the end, and that's all that matters.
It's just a little more athletic getting in the shower. That's about it.
Yeah, a little. Right, a little. We got to plan a little bit ahead.
So. There you go. Taylor and Judith, thanks so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you.
And good luck, Taylor.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Yeah, we'll be skating hard.
Taylor Chase is a member of the U.S. Paralympic sled hockey team profiled in the documentary Ice Warriors. Judith Vecchione is the executive producer of the documentary, co-produced by our partner WGBH in Boston. It premieres tonight on PBS. Back to the situation in Ukraine. All the analysts are suddenly caught off guard from the historic developments over the weekend. Was it a revolution or a coup d'etat? There's peace in Kiev after weeks of protests. But who will control things in the future? Nothing is entirely clear in Ukraine right now. Neither the whereabouts of now former President Viktor Yanukovych, nor the current allegiances in the political coalition that is running the country for the time being by parliamentary decree under Speaker of Parliament Alexander Turchynov. And what of just-released political prisoner Yulia Tymoshenko, or the fact that Ukraine needs a reported $35 billion to stay afloat? We reached out to Nikolai Petro, University of Rhode Island political science professor who is in Odessa, Ukraine, for a year on a Fulbright scholarship, and Professor Regina Smith in the political science department at Indiana University. In many ways, Smith says Ukraine is a country governed by all these very difficult questions.
I think it's very uncertain. Ukraine, the protest movement itself is very divided, the country is divided, and it's in economic shambles. So we're really in a moment of tremendous uncertainty.
Inside Ukraine, Nikolai, what is the task for whatever new government emerges here to knit this divided nation together? There's very much a strong pro-Russian region, a pro-European region, and individual factions within the opposition.
One thing they should avoid doing is dividing the country. And unfortunately, some of the first steps they've taken have been in the opposite direction of what needs to be done. I'm speaking specifically of the repeal of the law allowing Russian to be used locally, which was the main irritant in East-West relations. Introducing a resolution to outlaw the Communist Party of Ukraine, which is popular in the East and the South and is really the only remaining opposition party. Right now, the parliament can do whatever it wants because it has no representatives from the major party. Most of the deputies from the East and the South are simply afraid to set foot in the parliament. So they have to really make an effort to reach out or rule by themselves, which is going to leave a lot of people upset.
Regina, are these divisions that Nikolai is speaking about something left over from the Cold War, or do they go back even before the Cold War to World War II and even before that?
Well, they really come out of the Soviet nationalities policy, where the Soviet government sort of merged or put lots of Russian populations in non-Russian parts of the Soviet Union. And so those ethnic divisions really are reflective of a Stalinist policy.
And is there a way for the Ukrainian government to in some way recompense the grievances of these people? And then, Nikolai, I want you to jump in here.
There are several ways for it. I mean, I think the most important and most pressing problem is that Ukraine's about to go into default. And so if the government can find some way to stave off default and put the country on a more positive economic footing, that might go a long way to heal sort of grievances. In terms of institutions, they can give at least some governance power to these non-Ukrainian regions, which may sort of stave off some of the separatist sentiment that could emerge.
Nikolai?
I agree that some sort of power sharing and federalism really is probably the way to go. But the problem is that the driving force of the people who arranged the situation we have right now is a nationalist government, and they are ideologically opposed to that sort of power sharing, just as they're ideologically opposed to the very idea of speaking Russian in a public forum. There were fights in the parliament last year over that very fact. I mean, physical assaults. And that's what really is so troubling in this whole scenario.
So to both of you, then, is there a possibility that Yanukovych or someone affiliated with Yanukovych could pop up in Odessa or even Paris and mobilize some sort of expatriate kind of opposition movement to confront this fledgling government?
Well, I guess I'll start. No, I think there's no need for any expats. There's plenty of people here who know what they want. in the East and the South, at least, which is to just be left alone and to speak whatever language they want. And they feel that they're perfectly good Ukrainian citizens, only they don't want to be told what that means by a part of the country which has a very different history and memory of the Soviet period than they do. And so far, they haven't really organized themselves politically very effectively, or when they have, they've chosen people like Yanukovych, who was the worst, the best of a bad lot. Something better will have to come out of local political activism.
Regina Smith, is there a future to the Yanukovych doctrine in Ukraine, if not a future for Yanukovych himself?
Well, I don't think there's any future for Yanukovych, since all his allies have abandoned him both at home and abroad. I also think that the picture is very complicated by the fact that in the south, there is a large Tatar population, which has come out and said that they endorse the changes going on right now and would probably reject any sort of movement to get closer to Russia. And as Nikolai pointed out, the blue-collar workers, the working guys in eastern Ukraine, really haven't been so radical or organized. So there are some moderating forces here. And then there's the wild card of Yulia Tymoshenko, who may be the person who can sort of unify some of these groups and also get international support.
Can Tymoshenko glue the divided regions together, Nikolai Petro?
I'm not that optimistic. As a matter of fact, walking down the street here and listening to people and their instinctive reactions to Yulia, as they call her, it's very negative. She's part of the old regime in so many ways. There's so many things that have been happening now that can be laid at her doorstep. She's a blast from the past, not a new vision.
Nikolai Petro is a professor at the University of Rhode Island in Odessa, Ukraine, for a year on a Fulbright scholarship. He wants to remind everyone that he doesn't speak for the Fulbright program. Nikolai, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Regina Smith is associate professor of political science at Indiana University and a Russian expert there. Regina, thanks so much.
Nice to talk to you.
We want to remind you there's a lot going on at thetakeaway.org as this week begins. Were you a part of a fraternity in college? We will explore the proud history and troubled current moment in the Greek houses across the country. From Woodland, California, at my college, California State University East Bay, I have friends in both frats and sororities. In short, the hazing has its danger element, but it has shifted to more humiliation. Don't know if it's any better. From Eugene, Oregon, though, oh, please, it's young people playing hard who work hard. There's no harm. I think wussy people overreact after one bad incident. You can tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org or facebook.com/@thetakeaway. There are plenty of real stories up for Oscar awards this year, and this week we will bring some reality to the glitz of Hollywood awards season. We'll talk with people who are at the center of some of the real stories in the movies up for awards. We've got the great-great-great-grandson of Solomon Northup from 12 Years a Slave, the president of the Dallas Gay Alliance who worked with Ron Woodruff of Dallas Buyers Club, and even a member of the prosecution team from the investigation that became American Hustle. Gregory Wallen says it was a real live hustle.
I was just a couple of years out of law school. I had just joined the U.S. Attorney's Office in Brooklyn. And after I had done two or three trials, I was assigned, which were very small cases, theft from mailbox type of cases. I was assigned to work on the biggest political corruption investigation of Congress, certainly in American history. And it was a thrill.
Tune in every day this week. We'll set the record straight and celebrate some of the Oscar-nominated history in our series, Real People, Best Pictures. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.